Good morning. Welcome to Back Chat. I'm Hugh Chiverton. Your co-host today is Andrew Work. Andrew, good morning to you.
Good morning, Hugh.
Nice to have you back. The Exchange Fund has announced a record loss of $63.8 billion in the third quarter of this year. The fund is used to defend the Hong Kong dollar and for the first 9 months of 2015 posted an overall net loss of $36.8 billion. That means a loss of about $5,000 per head of our population. The head of the Monetary Authority, Chief Executive Norman Chan, blamed the volatile financial market and the mainland's economic issues and said the situation was out of his hands. So what's gone wrong? Why are the losses so large? Have the investments been too risky or too conservative? Would more transparency on investments make any difference? Email us with your thoughts and comments. Our address is backchat@rthk.hk. We'd like to hear from you, backchat@rthk.hk. Or you can go to our Facebook page, that's Backchat on RTHK Radio 3, and comment there, or call us 233 88266. Later in the programme, the MTR's new rules on carrying musical instruments. Joining us for our first discussion, we have in our central studio David Webb, stock analyst, founder of website.com, a shareholder activist, Francis Lun, who's the chief executive officer of GEO Securities, and Enzio von Pfeil, investment strategist with private capital. And also joining us on the line is Professor David Cook, professor of economics at the University of Science and Technology. Gentlemen, good morning. Thank
morning.
You very much for coming in. David Webb, first of all, maybe we'll start with you. What do you make of this? It's a massive loss, but then there's a lot of money there, isn't there?
Well, it sounds like a lot of money to most people. I mean, you could almost build a railway to Shenzhen for that money. Or you could almost build another bridge to Lantau just to save a few people from missing their flights. But in context, here are the facts. At the end of 2014, the total assets in the exchange fund, net assets attributable to the government, were about 1.7 trillion Hong Kong dollars, 1,700 billion or 1.7 million million. And that's about $200,000 per head of the population, man, women and child. And so the actual percentage loss so far this year is about 2%. And I've looked at the profile of the investments, which is only disclosed once per year at the end of each calendar year. And in the last 5 years, from 2009 to 2014, so two things. First of all, the amount we've been hoarding away has gone up from 1.1 trillion to 1.7 trillion. So we've got an extra $600 billion stashed away. Mm-hmm. Which I think is money that, this is the bigger question, is why is the government hoarding this money and taking it out of the public purse, that the public's capacity to spend is being depleted by that amount. And secondly, in terms of asset weighting, the amount they have in equities has gone up from about 32.5% of the net assets to 34.1%. So not a big increase, about 1.6% increase in the equity weighting. But in dollar terms, it's quite a big increase because two things there. First of all, the amount they keep in the Hong Kong stock market has hardly changed. It went up from $143 billion in 2009 to $157 billion in 2014. And people tend to forget that the government still holds Hong Kong stocks, which I think is a conflict of interest when it comes to things like regulating the price of electricity. If you hold shares in the electricity generators, you'd rather like them to make good returns, and the rate of return that they get is determined by the government and negotiation. And then overseas equities, they have gone up from, in 2009, $215 billion to $419 billion. So they've doubled the amount that they hold in overseas equities, and in percentage terms, they've reduced the amount they hold in Hong Kong equities, though the dollar amount's about the same. So there's the picture of what they're doing with the money. But here's the big question is, why on earth are we running these structural surpluses? And they're in breach of the basic law, in fact, because the basic law requires the government to do two things. One is to balance the budget and not to deliberately aim for a surplus all the time. And secondly, it requires them to keep the growth in expenditure in line with the growth in the GDP, the economy. And they've been basically breaching both of those requirements on a sustainable basis. You could forgive a one-off problem, a missed budget during SARS or an excess budget because of a stock market frenzy generating excessive stamp duty, but they've actually been, on a structural basis, hoarding our money.
Okay. A lot of points raised there. The first one is that figure. I mean, you said 1.7 trillion?
That's right, yes. That includes the accumulated surplus, the profit over the years that the exchange fund has made.
Okay, because I'm looking at a press report which says...
They like to think nobody owns that.
Okay. I'm looking at a press report which says 3.27 trillion.
Those are the total assets, but from that you have to deduct the obligations of the fund to the PEG, basically, the banking system, the notes and coins in circulation, and what they call certificates of indebtedness. That's the deposits that back the notes issued by the note-issuing banks, the three of them. Mm-hmm. So you need to look at the net position and remember that the ebbs and flows of the money through the PEG mechanism, they don't belong to us. They basically, for every Hong Kong dollar the government issues, it receives a compensating amount of US dollars or other foreign currencies.
So the 1.7 trillion is essentially money in hand.
That is our money. That's the public's money. It is not... It's not needed to back the PEG, and in fact, an orthodox currency board would not have such a huge amount of excess assets. It should be disbursed.
Okay, Francis Leung, good morning to you.
Yeah, good morning.
If you look at it like that, a loss of, what were you saying, 2% or something, that's not too bad with the stock market doing what it's doing, is it?
Well, in all fairness to Norman Chan, all these losses are actually paper losses. They are not really operating losses. They occur because the stock market crashed and then also the U.S. dollar appreciated. But then the Norman Chan is like the CFO of Hong Kong. You are in a thankless job. Damn if you do and damn if you don't. You don't get bonuses for making a lot of money. But then if you lose money, you really get vilified. So what... If you want to keep a stable ship and not record any losses, then you should keep everything in U.S. dollar treasury. But even then, you will have some fluctuation because bond prices vary too in line with the exchange rate. So I think it's a seasonal fluctuation. I think we really should not be too harsh on Norman Chan.
So no heads are going to roll because of this?
Definitely no. Well, even though Norman Chan makes $10 million a year, I think it's something like five times that of Janet Yellen. He basically assumes no responsibility for his actions.
It is a good time, though, to be asking for more transparency in exactly how they're managing this money. I don't think we know what their benchmark is, how much equity risk they're trying to take, and whether they're under or outperforming the benchmark. So maybe it's a good time for legislators to be pressing them to start reporting their equity positions quarterly, to disclose all their portfolio. Are they investing in uniformly in overseas equities, or are they picking stocks? Are they excluding anything like tobacco companies, or are they taking a across the board approach?
Yeah, maybe they just put part of the money into a company like Temasek or GIC or CIC, and establish a government equity fund and let them invest globally.
Enzio, would the transparency that they don't use, apparently, would that match up with what you see in the private sector? Would that be acceptable?
No, I don't think that any fund manager losing $64 billion would be, A, commanding a rather handsome salary, and B, probably keeping his job. He may start relying on his MPF. That's a different subject, of course. Now, I would say the thing that disturbs me a bit is the colossal set of mismatches. I mean, the exchange fund ordinance says that it's the monies are there to affect the exchange value of the Hong Kong dollars. Now, quite why, and David can maybe correct me here, but quite what equities and foreign currencies, non-dollar currencies, are doing in a PEG system, which is really pretty simple to keep things stable against the U.S. dollars, I just don't know. But it sounds to me like somebody's roping around.
Well, these are basically it's a hybrid animal, the exchange fund, because of its massive surplus relative to its PEG obligations. It does have... More than enough low-risk assets to back the peg, but it's all commingled with basically a sovereign wealth fund, which, as I said, has about 34% of its net assets in stocks here and overseas. And, you know, if that were a long-term savings fund and you were a young person, which the government perpetually is because it never is never going to die, then maybe it should have more of an equity weighting. But then the question is, you know, why is the money there in the first place? I think if it is there, maybe they should be taking a bit more risk and having a higher equity weighting. You know, because they're not likely to draw on it in any rapid way, even in a deficit situation, they might withdraw 20% of that money. Mm-hmm. It really is time, I think, to think about separating the two things and having an exchange fund for the
peg
and a sovereign wealth fund for the government's hoard, and then they could be more honest about how much money they're hoarding. Any surplus from the exchange fund should be paid into the sovereign wealth fund, and then we'd have a clear picture of what the two things are, separating them.
Yeah, okay. I think that's a good idea.
All right. David Cook, Professor Cook, good morning to you.
Hi.
Thank you much indeed for joining us. What do you think? What do you make of the loss? What do you think of David Webb's idea that perhaps they should be they should have a higher risk strategy?
So number one, I just wanted to note that one of the things that he said was that the government is perpetually young because it's going to live forever. But we should keep in mind that in Hong Kong's case, that's not true. That is to say that we have a 50 years after the handover in which Hong Kong will retain its high degree of autonomy.
So we better spend it while we can. Huh?
That's 32 years and left, I believe, at this time. So I guess you could think of Hong Kong, if the average lifespan of the Hong Konger is something like 80 years, that we can think of Hong Kong as a middle-aged person. Ooh. Right now, so that's something to keep in mind
when we think about our equity fund is to think
about that final date.
I mean, Hong Kong may be in structural decline because of the way China is micromanaging it, but are you saying that we should prepare for retirement as an economy?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think if we're going to be economists about it, that we should be thinking about that final date not wanting to amass a big amount of money that ultimately is going to be somebody else's to spend. So that as a taxpayer, that's something that we should think about.
You mean for when Hong Kong becomes a big retirement home, essentially?
Well, no, I mean when the Hong Kong government is itself retired. What happens to this portfolio in 2047? So that's
somebody will have to get their hands on
Donald Trump will be running the money by then.
Right. Well, somebody will, and that's not clear who it's going to be.
You've identified a very important question, which has to be answered by about 2027, which is: are we going to get an extension of the basic law and our way of life? People will be making long-term contracts. They'll be wondering whether the Court of Final Appeal will still be the highest court, or whether it'll be the Guangzhou People's Municipal Court, and then the Central Court in Beijing.
All right.
There are issues to be dealt with.
Yeah. Okay, David Cook, you opened a can of worms there. Can you set them aside? You wanted to make another point, did you?
We're not interrupting, David. Okay, so in some sense, we have already split the portfolio between that's necessary to back the peg. So we have a backing portfolio, and which is highly liquid U.S. dollar securities. So we are operating a very clear money market fund, which should be very safe. So this will have no impact on the peg. And they do break out the government's fiscal reserves and other deposits by various statutory bodies in their balance sheet. So we do understand that. David Webb identified the fact that we do have this accumulated surplus, the ownership of which is is a bit nebulous, and so that is a political.
Well, it clearly belongs to the people. I mean, it's not to the Tooth Fairy or Santa Claus. It's the money accountable to the government in the end, and for the government to perpetually pretend that it's not there is just specious and misleading. It's Hong Kong money.
That's right, and so I guess in terms of that investment portfolio, it does seem that they run a very diversified set of funds and probably are getting returns that are sort of tracking the returns that you might get from such a thing. They took a lot of losses this year as the dollar strengthened and other currencies weakened. So in Hong Kong dollar terms, some of their losses are attributable to that. In the recent period, it's more of the equity. And that I think is something that's sort of unavoidable, that they've gotten a lot of income from their equity investments over the last cycle, but that's kind of topping out. But all of these investments in equities does raise the question of transparency.
Well, also the amount that they have split between individual stocks, active funds, and ETFs, my pet peeve.
Oh, yeah. I really don't know about that. I mean, I think, my impression is that they really try to have a very diversified portfolio.
It's mostly outsourced to asset management firms. It helps prop up the industry here.
Enzio, give rein to your peeve. Explain what upsets you so much.
Well, if you're only going to be performing in line with the index, and if it's true that 86% of all active fund managers underperform the index, then I kind of wonder why people are spending, and presumably also the exchange fund, a lot of money on managing monies of that site when they could be doing a heck of a lot better just by tracking indices and not trying to be clever about it.
But they seem to be outperforming the market.
We don't know. I don't think they've published proper benchmarks against which they're measuring themselves, and that's where I'm calling for more transparency in that. We need to have frequent reporting of performance against benchmarks. If they're telling us that they are targeting one-third equities, two-thirds bonds and cash, then let's see the benchmarks that measures that performance.
No, but you just look at the profit and loss of the exchange fund over the first part of this year. You said it was, 2% something? And markets, the Hang Seng over that period? It's down.
The Hang Seng is, if you add back the dividends, it's roughly break-even now, I think, the end of October. I haven't checked for September.
Calls for transparency, said LegCo should be pushing for this. Do you think LegCo understands this?
Probably not.
And if there's,
not the fishing and agricultural legislator, for example, or the sports and recreation legislator.
Yeah, really. And then you've got the functional constituency finance rep, and of course, as you say, it's propping up the industry in Hong Kong. Does he want to upset his constituency by opening that up and demanding more transparency?
Actually, I don't think the driving force for hoarding reserves is giving more money to asset managers to manage. The driving force is excessive conservatism in the government, mm-hmm. overly prudent. And also a structural issue, which is that the utility of land that they sell lasts for at least the initial 50 years of the lease and probably beyond, but they're charging it all up front as a premium. Mm-hmm. Except for 3% rateable value on the ground rent. And I've said this many times, we need to restructure land leases. All new leases should be for much higher ground rents and much lower premiums to spread that income out, which will reduce the temptation to hoard it up front or to fritter it away on grandiose infrastructure projects.
Professor Cook, do you want to comment?
Oh, I just want to say that one of the reasons that they give for accumulating these relatively high surpluses is the central bank's role as a lender of last resort. So if we have this very tight monetary policy of an exchange fund, then that reduces the latitude of the central bank to use monetary policy or create liquidity to bail out the banking system in the presence of a crisis. But an advantage of having a lot of accumulated reserves is going to be that those reserves can be used to back up the...
Sorry, I think, Professor, that's a mistake, isn't it? These are foreign reserves. They're not local assets. The ability of the exchange fund to print Hong Kong dollars is unlimited, so it can, as the Fed did, buy assets with newly created Hong Kong dollars if it needs to create liquidity.
But that's not consistent with a pegged exchange rate. So you can, if you have a floating exchange rate or if you have a flexible monetary policy, then yes, you can use liquidity to act as a lender of last resort. But as we say, those funds are essentially going to be tied down by the peg. The surplus funds could be used in a lender of last resort role. And of course, we know that our banking system has a lot of external liabilities, a lot of external assets as well. And so some of those external assets...
Shouldn't we just let banks fail and allow the resolution process to work? I mean, isn't that market forces? And we do have a prioritization system so that it's called the deposit protection scheme rather than guarantee scheme, because what it does is give small depositors priority over large ones in a liquidation.
Right. So we do have a deposit insurance, and that is acting as a rule. But I think it is true that in terms of some sort of systemic crisis, that there is a public policy role for government to bail out the financial system if it's indeed a liquidity crisis, as we've seen various banks in our history face kind of these sorts of crises. But there is a point, which is that deposit insurance does come with a fee to the banks, and so if the government is accumulating reserves for this lender of last resort,
there's no insurance in Hong Kong. There is no deposit insurance. There's only a prioritization of claims under the deposit protection system. So if you have up to $500,000, you, along with other people in that bucket, will rank ahead of the rest of the claims of people with larger deposits. Your first $500,000 gets first dibs on the assets of the bank when it fails, and that's usually enough to cover, that's the theory anyway, to cover the... depositors.
Okay, I'd say corrected. I didn't really understand.
They're not paying any insurance premium to some central pool of assets or to the government.
Yeah. All right, but it was true that during the global financial crisis that the government did step in and insure all Hong Kong bank deposits
in
Hong Kong dollar and foreign currency terms.
It guaranteed them, and it crossed its fingers behind its back, because it basically would have to issue a lot of bonds to pay for it if it did come to that.
I just want to move a little bit away from the minutiae of this back to the performance of the exchange fund. If I look at the annual report, the reserves management, we see that the three-year average from 2012 to 14 was up a stonking 2.8%. Five-year average was 2.6%, and a 10-year average has been 3.7% now. I'm not a database that can be downloaded, but I can tell you that the stock markets in the aggregate have done a lot better than that. So when it was asserted that the exchange fund has been outperforming, I would really beg to differ. I don't think it has been. Besides which, I am concerned about the mismatches. If we have Hong Kong dollar liabilities here in Hong Kong for our spending purposes, then what on earth are we roping around in Australian dollars, Canadian dollars, and sterling for?
Francis Lund, I know you're going at 9 o'clock.
yes.
Are you worried about that?
Yeah, I think if you want to be prudent and you don't want to get attacked for underperforming, you should hold everything in U.S. dollar assets.
Or ETFs.
Yeah, in this case, if you're going to hold stocks, Hong Kong stocks, by ETF 2800, and then...
Francis can broker it for you.
We'll charge a very low premium.
Very low, good price.
Yeah, commission rate.
Very smart.
It was the government that created the tracker fund. Do remember that.
Yes. But Francis Lin, I mean, problems in China, they don't seem to be going away, do they? I mean, are we just going to get more of these kind of losses?
I think it's time for
Norman Chan says it's out of his hands.
I think we would like to know how much of the assets.
Well, that's a pathetic excuse. It's out of our hands. I mean, it's a little bit like somebody who runs a rather large bank saying that how could he possibly know what's going on in his divisions? I think he's based in London.
Yeah, Norman Chan should get fired for this. You know?
We'd certainly like to know how much of the money is invested in mainland China. That would be interesting because if we're trying to be separate and independent, but have high autonomy, sinking our money into Chinese bonds is a bit of a risk. If you buy government bonds in China, you're basically transferring reserves to the Chinese government.
Is that an argument not to have transparency there? Because that's, as you know, it's going to become very politicised.
I think they should.
Someone's going to say there's not enough. Someone's going to say there's too much.
But Norway has the largest pension fund in the world, and it's transparent. I don't see why we can't be.
But I'm guessing they don't invest it all in Norway. I'm sure they've got it spread out around the world.
But at least the point, of course, is that they're transparent.
They converted their oil into foreign reserves, basically. That's because there's such a relatively small population, and they know the oil will run out before the population does.
But given our delicate relationship with the mainland?
We should know, yes, given that.
We can, for a change, assert ourselves and at least ask them to put these things down on. It is one country, two systems, but it seems as if a lot of the locals are petrified of China and sort of think that this is what we should do because they might react as follows, and that's all wrong in my head. We're not asserting ourselves.
Should we follow Li Ka-shing, for example?
The basic law requires Hong Kong to keep its finances separate from the mainland. Now, if we are funneling money to the Chinese government by buying its bonds, then they
might be prudent
separate.
Investments. It's not a question of funneling funds.
No, it's a question of avoiding conflicts of interest. We already have enough issues with control from Beijing.
Well, that's completely impossible when it comes to China, isn't it?
Well, I mean, there is the issue this summer that the central government asked various financial institutions in China, including the People's Banks, to help support the stock market in China. I'm sure that the exchange fund was not involved in any of that.
Really? But, how are you sure that Hong Kong wasn't kind of encouraged to do their part to help the motherland?
I'm not 100% positive, but I would be shocked if they had been a part of that.
Shocking things are frequently revealed in Hong Kong over the last couple of years.
I think it's a thing. It's a situation where if they were more open, that they could build confidence about their strategy.
All right, we can return to that in a couple of minutes' time, just after the news at 9 o'clock. Just before that, the weather. We say goodbye to Francis Lynn, I think, for the moment. Thank you very much indeed. We're mainly cloudy today with some sunny periods. Maximum temperature about 27 degrees, 24 degrees latest readings. Humidity 75%. Welcome back to the incomplete, misleading back chat this Wednesday morning with Andrew Work and me, Hugh Chiverton. We continue to talk about the exchange fund loss, $63 billion in just one quarter announced this year of the exchange fund, the fund that's basically used to defend the Hong Kong dollar. We're talking about the implications of that, what the exchange fund is for as well, how it could be managed. We have with us Professor David Cook from the University of Science and Technology, for Professor of Economics there, Enzio von Pfahl, who's an investment strategist with Private Capital, and David Webb, a stock analyst, founder of website.com, shareholder activist. Later, also going to be talking about ongoing controversy over the MTR's new rules on carrying large musical instruments. They said they'd come up with these rules and people could get permits. Well, the musicians, it seems, are still not happy. We'll be talking to one of them about the implications of that. If you want to comment, we would like to hear from you. You can just pick up the phone, 233-88266. You can go to our Facebook page, which is Backchat on RTHK Radio 3, or you can email us. That's backchat@rthk.hk, backchat@rthk.hk, if you want to comment. Anthony, thank you very much, on our Facebook page, says, can Backchat compare the loss with a benchmark, like an index with similar asset mix? The size of the exchange fund is about 2.679 billion as of 31st of August 2015. The loss in 3 months, only about 2.4%. Is it still large? Correct me if I'm wrong. Professor Cook, would you say this is a large loss or a small loss?
I guess it's a 2% loss. In a year that's basically kind of been flat in financial markets, it seems like that they are kind of in a situation where U.S. dollar exchange rates are becoming stronger, and so there's going to be a natural foreign currency loss. there, but the loss in equities is probably, you know, just reflects what's going on in equity markets. So I guess this is for a well diversified portfolio.
I thought that in my supreme ignorance that a stronger dollar would help our exchange fund.
Well, we have assets in euro and so when the U.S. dollar goes up and the Hong Kong dollar goes up relative to the euro, the Hong Kong dollar value of those assets
drops. And this is the question: why are we working around?
Well, there was a time when it was a much more orthodox currency board, and they only held U.S. dollars,
yes,
basically, and U.S. dollar treasury notes and bonds. So, but now there is a portfolio of other assets denominated in other currencies.
I think there's a benefit to diversification. So you probably want to have assets that rise in value when the local economy is not doing well.
One of the drawbacks of having an equity position at all when you're a government is that it's going to be correlated with deficits in your budget, because at times when the global economy is in a slump, the value of equities will also slump, as it did during the global financial crisis, and at the same time, companies domestically will make less profit and pay less tax, and so you'll have a bigger deficit. So at the time that you need to draw on that money, the value of the assets you've stashed away will be going down. And that's maybe why they've stopped at, or at least seem to be holding level at around 34% equities in the net assets of the fund that belong to the taxpayer. The other 66% is in less assets that are less prone to downturns, basically. Then,
like the euro, the Australian dollar, and the Canadian dollar, right?
Well,
yeah.
We don't know how much is allocated to each stock market or even to each currency from month to month. But that's why I think we should have greater transparency over exactly what their benchmarks are, whether they are, for example, globally investing in equities relative to the size of the markets in each country, or do they have a preference for certain countries over others? Do they have, for example, zero weighting on Russia and higher disproportionate weighting on the USA or the UK?
This brings me to one other point that I wanted to just stress, maybe because I started under von Hayek, but I'm very leery of this whole forecasting business, having done it for 30 years myself. And I suspect that a lot of the underperformance is due, in fact, to people saying, well, I think the U.S. is going up, or I think China is going sideways, or whatever. And that's one of the, again, a structural reason why this performance really has been pretty sort of not exciting, let's say.
Sorry, I don't understand. The problem is people making predictions.
Making predictions because you can never, as we all know, you can never be consistently right, so we're all going to get it right now and then. But it seems as if this time, when Norman Chan says that it was just out of his hands, well, I don't know. I mean, if you're forecasting the whole time, then of course it's out of your hands, because you can never be consistently right.
Mm. And this is an email from G, who says, Norman Chan must be taking advice from his private banker. Having opted for risk category one, he must be thoroughly sick of the compliance spiel each time he wants to make a new investment.
That's an interesting question. Is the fund bound by the same rules as everybody else, or do they get a special pass?
They're above the law. They transcend the Securities and Futures Ordinance, one might say. And we know this because in 1998, when Donald Jung invaded the stock market and bought equities for the first time for the exchange fund, they said, well, we're not bound by the disclosure laws. We don't have to say which stocks we have more than 10% of, which was the threshold at the time. And we're also not bound by the laws against market manipulation, which is exactly what we're doing when we try to force up the futures market to counter what we say is other people's manipulation. On multiple levels, they're not bound by the law as far as they see it. But they make a voluntary disclosure, for example, of their shareholding in the MTR. And they've made a voluntary disclosure of their shareholding in Hong Kong exchanges, which will be one of the assets that slumped big time in the third quarter, because as the steam went out of the China Connect bubble and all that stuff, Hong Kong exchanges and clearing share price dropped a lot. So
how's the Connect doing?
Well, it's still there. It does what it's supposed to do,
okay.
I think, except on public holidays, which are never synchronized between the two places, but and days either side of that.
David Cook, would you like to see more transparency? Would that make us more money?
Yeah, well, I guess I'd say that that they have become more transparent over time. That is, that you know, they present their balance sheets on a monthly basis, and there is a significant improvement, and maybe the global leaders like Norway Sovereign Wealth Fund, they could definitely be more transparent, but probably by regional standards, they're quite transparent.
But the monthly accounts are only very condensed. They don't say how much they have in equities.
Let me give you an example of the category securities on the monthly accounts. It says, let us go to note 2. Note 2 says securities comprise highly liquid marketable equity and debt securities. Now, that's real insight. I mean, that really gets me down the track of understanding why they've had this underperformance.
Yeah,
you only
find out once a year how much they have in equities. Now, if this was a listed company anywhere in Asia except Hong Kong, it would have to report quarterly. In Hong Kong, it would be half yearly. But at least you would have a disclosure twice a year on the amount of equities that they're holding. So let's have more information about this. I think it can't be
right.
A bad thing.
Well, the main channel by which we hold the government accountable in Hong Kong is through public discussion. And so probably
not the ballot box, certainly.
That means transparency is extremely important here.
Yeah. Hmm. So how did this thing get formed with this kind of, as you say, above the law or transcending the SFC? How did that come to be? And why does it persist?
I brought this up in one of my earliest articles on website in 1998 was about this. And basically they take the view that under the interpretation ordinance, I think is ordinance number 1, a law only applies to the government if it must by necessary implication do so. And that's a legalistic term. And I say it necessarily must because they are in the market and we need to know if they're building positions and manipulating it, and they shouldn't be doing that. They take the view that that's not a high enough level of necessity to make the law applicable to the government.
So
the basic rule is that unless a law specifically says that it binds the government, which, for example, the Bill of Rights Ordinance does, if it doesn't say that, then it has to be necessary an implication of the law. For example, the law against driving the wrong way down a one-way street probably should apply to government drivers, otherwise we'll have more accidents. So those sorts of laws ought to, by necessary implication, apply.
But things like the Labour Ordinance don't, do they? I know as a civil servant,
right.
we're reminded of this. The Labour Ordinance doesn't apply to the government.
Really?
Yep. I think we do it voluntarily.
Is there something confusion in all of this? That the government's...
It's probably colonial. It's more likely to be colonial.
All right. Well, it starts with a C. Okay. Bit of insight there.
It harks back to the royal immunity.
Andrew, I think you've got a special guest this evening.
Yeah, we're going to be Lion Rock Institute's having their 11th annual
dinner.
You
were one of the founders of the Lion Rock Institute?
I was, yeah, with Shun Pak Man and Simon Lee Chow Fu. And we've got John Tsang on the podium tonight in front of a crowd. So if I was going to ask if you guys have any questions that we could put to him while we're there, what would be your number one question you'd like us to
when
ask?
When are you resigning?
No, just why, yes, that's one, but also just why this, what we were just discussing, why this, I think, rather arrogant lack of transparency when it comes to understanding what's happening with taxpayers' money in these various exchange fund accounts.
And why are you targeting surpluses all the time in the budget process?
I mean, right. I'd be interested in the long-term plans for the exchange fund over a 30-year horizon, what their current strategic thinking is on that.
I mean, a responsible government would look at that money and say, this is clearly not an asset, it's actually a liability to our fiscal planning. We will announce a program over the next 10 years of returning that the bulk of the excess to the public through a program of deficits. We will do it through a combination of tax cuts and increased spending where needed in appropriate welfare areas, education, healthcare, and so on. We will aim to reduce that back to the proportion of GDP that it was in 1997.
Which was?
Probably about a quarter of where it is now in terms of the $1.7 trillion that we've got. And then we will run a balanced budget. We will take the average of the last 5 years of our budget and make sure that that's our midpoint in next year's budget.
So if they keep 25%, David, you said it's $200,000 for every man, woman, and child. No, you know, I'd be looking 50. For a check for $150,000.
Well, it won't come directly.
You got $6,000.
I could use it.
Be happy.
I certainly wouldn't distribute it that way. Look at the $6,000 scheme and magnify it. That was not a good idea.
Another question that I would be raising
but
is...
Imagine the stimulative effect of leaving more money in people's pockets through reductions of salaries tax, profits tax, eliminating various forms of stamp duty so that assets can transfer more easily, people can move homes more easily, and so on, you know, increasing flexibility in the economy.
One final question that I would raise is why this consistent set of mismatching on the foreign exchange side, for instance. What are we doing roping around in Canadian dollars and in sterling and in euros and in yen, for heaven's sakes, when we pretty much have dollar liabilities, even on the spending side? Also, that goes, I'm sure, for maturity mismatches and instrumental mismatches. Why so much equity if we have fixed outlays sometimes?
Is that a question for John Tsang or Norman Chan? Yeah, both?
Both, yeah. Yeah, but very much John Tsang, yeah.
Surely in recent years he's targeted a deficit, mild deficit. That's been the target, hasn't it? But they've had unexpected windfalls, basically, from property markets.
Because they made
so
excessively conservative assumptions in the revenue side. You know, the fact is that if you took the average of the last 5 years and said, okay, we're going to have to pay that back by means of a deficit this year, then you would get yourself into a rolling cycle in which you would basically even everything out. And instead, we're up by about $500 billion in 5 years.
But we're in kind of a bizarre position in Hong Kong, aren't we? Because every other government in the world seems to be in deficit and in panic about their long-term position because they can only see things like especially healthcare becoming more and more expensive and no idea how they're going to deal with it, whereas Hong Kong seems to be the opposite. I mean, is there not a concern that if the conservatism in the finance department disappears, we're going to get like everybody else and just have ridiculous, out-of-control spending?
Well, you're suggesting they would swing from one extreme to the other. I think there's a midpoint to be reached.
I think there's a middle way, yeah, that can be more prudent.
Theoretically,
We don't. I mean, we're a happy place in the sense that we don't have to pay a dime for defense, for example. Mm-hmm. We only have foreign trade offices, but no overseas diplomatic service. And we have a very compact geography, so we don't have to subsidize farmers by paying for their phone lines or anything like that, like Australia does. You know, there's a very efficient three-dimensional space that we live in rather than sprawling city. So I would think that anyone in that situation should be able to run on 20% of GDP, which is roughly where the government should be and has been historically in its expenditure.
Mm-hmm. Right. Given that the position of the Chinese economy and the likely slowdown of growth there and the changing demographics in Hong Kong, we are probably going to tilt toward deficits in the immediate future.
Well, the way that we're spending on Kowloon cultural hubs, which nobody knows what is going on, no wonder.
It's a Kowloon cultural desert, actually.
Yes.
Correct term. You know, and then it's collided with the express rail train, which sort of goes underneath it, and so the whole thing is on hold. But when it eventually is finished, it'll be a very fast way to get to nowhere, because you'll arrive in West Kowloon and say, now how do I get to Central or Quarry Bay or wherever you really want to go.
So David Cook, just one little peek finally inside that can of worms. What does the administration say about it? Does it have an official line on 2047 from an economic point of view?
I don't think so. I guess they're opting for constructive ambiguity, but those are, I guess, the questions that, you know, given the size of the outstanding exchange fund, you know, even if we ran deficits of 2% of GDP per year, we should still have, you know, surplus funds going forward for 30 years or more. So, you know, just thinking about that, you know, strategically, it's time to start thinking about that.
Yeah, we could basically spend $50 billion a year for the next 32 years and come out with about $100 billion remaining.
Right. So they could, you know, conceivably just cancel income taxes for the rest of our lives.
For the rest of the SAR, yeah.
Not if they're roping around in mismatched currencies, they won't. Yeah.
Right.
Well, they would have to bring down salaries tax and profits tax at the same time, otherwise people will arbitrage between them. But there's certainly a case to be made for going to a flat rate of tax at around 10% rather than the 15% and 16.5% that they currently charge on those two taxes.
Well, I know I see Mark Simon over at Next Media has been kind of picking at that, gnawing on that bone about middle class tax cuts recently. Maybe now's the time. There's always a time to cut taxes. I like that kind of thinking. All right.
Okay. Well, thank you very much indeed, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Professor David Cook from the University of Science and Technology, NDO on file, investment strategist with private capital, and shareholder activist David Webb. Thank you very much indeed for joining us this morning. Also speaking earlier to Francis Lund, Chief Executive Officer of GEO Securities. 21 minutes past nine. Finally.